When Peter Wortzmann first went to Berlin as a student back in the 1970s, he immediately fell in love with the city. As the son of German-speaking Jewish refugees from Vienna, he's found that Berlin's constantly evolving energy can stimulate a whole range of emotions. And making Berlin his second home has required Peter to grapple with some powerful ghosts from its past. Peter is an accomplished playwright, author, and translator. The Bloomsbury Review called him a 20th century Brother Grimm. He's just written a masterful poetic account of Berlin and his experiences in its haunted streets and buildings. The book's called Ghost Dance in Berlin, A Rhapsody in Grey. Peter Wortzmann joins us right now to tell us about it on Travel with Rick Steves. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rick. I'm really delighted and honored to be on your show.
Thank you. Now, tell us just briefly about your experience over the years in Berlin. When have you lived and why were you there, and how did it inspire you to write your book?
Well, I should say for me, Berlin is loaded, isn't always will be loaded, but isn't always will be really alive. I first experienced Berlin as a Fulbright scholar in 73. I remember telling the Fulbright Commission that this was a very difficult year for me. I was actually based in Freiburg in the Black Forest at the time, and we regrouped in Berlin. And I remember arriving in Berlin and immediately falling in love with the energy of the city. At that time, there were two Berlins. There was the West Berlin and East Berlin. And this was a city that was really alive. This was a city where I suspected at the time, and now I'm convinced, that the wild creative energy of the 1920s is still alive there. And that Joseph Goebbels, the at-time Gauleiter of Berlin under Hitler, did not succeed in ridding the city of this anarchic spirit.
The subtitle of your book, Ghost Dance of Berlin, is A Rhapsody in Grey. And then you write, the city is cold, unblinking, littered, sad with memorials. At the same time, it's a city that seems to give you energy.
I think what's amazing about this place is, in its very grayness, it is one of the most joyous places that I've ever been to. Perhaps it's a longing for the sunny south. The sun doesn't show through until well into April. If you arrive, as I did on January 1st, on my last day, 2010, you don't see the sun. It blinks at you, but you never see it. And yet there's something about this place. Perhaps people turned inwards. The warmth of a cafe, the introverted nature, the bookishness, the raucous nature of this place, there's something unbelievably attractive about it.
Now, you've written this incredible fantasy kind of story, the premise of your book. You've got ghosts that go back and forth from a present-day perch on a lakeside mansion, and you imagine these sets of ghosts, and one of them is the exiled Jewish banker family that owned this mansion. And the other is Hitler's minister of finance and his entourage that took over the mansion. And then you got another gaggle of ghosts that look across the lake as they plan the final solution, the extermination of the Jewish race. And then you've got your characters jumping back and forth over what was the wall. Talk about how that helps you explain how you find Berlin so fascinating.
2010 was the coldest winter in the last three decades. And so I actually, in what I think of as a great Semitic tradition, walked on water. I took some ginger steps at first, and then I saw a hockey team skating across the lake. And I walked out into the middle of this mythic, infamous lake, Wannsee. Maybe many of your listeners have heard of the Wannsee Conference. This was one of the most horrible conferences in history, where they decided upon how to efficiently organize the mass extermination of a people. That's happening on one side. That's right next to the Liebermann Villa, Villa of Max Liebermann, a Jewish impressionist painter who revolutionized painting in Berlin and then was turned out of the very academy that he had founded. The villa that I lived in was owned originally by the Arnhold family. The Arnhold family were Jewish bankers, originally bankers to Bismarck. This gets into the very paradox of Berlin life. Bismarck was an anti-Semite who, of course, had to have a Jewish banker to finance his growing imperial needs and desires. The Arnhold family fled, and Hitler gave the house to Walter Funk, his minister of finance. And I, in my insomniac imagination, when one has insomnia, everything becomes metaphor in a way, I heard the rustling of ghosts around me. I speak in part metaphorically and poetically. I tried to imagine what these two presences, how could they could deal with each other? The presence of the Arnhold family and their guests. It was a villa in which there was a kind of artistic and literary salon, a salon reaching back to the 19th century, these great salons of Rachel Varnhagen. Rachel Varnhagen was a converted Jewish woman in whose salons the artistic and literary elite of Berlin, of Germany, gathered together, and who, several years later, decided, this is after Napoleon's invasion, decided that they would no longer eat at table with their former hosts, and they founded the Deutsche Tischgesellschaft, at which Jews were excluded. But Berlin has always been, I don't know if melting pot is the right word, this giant oozing bratwurst of a place in which, somewhat like the native Vienna of my parents, was a place certainly of the 20th century where you cannot extract the Jewish element from cultural life of this place.
You wrote in your book, to this day, I often feel like one of those plump, round, hand-painted Russian wooden matryoshka dolls with a German embedded in my English, Yiddish inside the German, Hebrew pulsing in the Yiddish, and the universal cry of a newborn echoing within. It's like you're wrestling with your identity in a city that's wrestling with its own identity. And then I picture you standing on this frozen Wannsee. Is that where the idea of writing this book came to you, actually, when you're standing on that frozen lake, looking at the mansion and looking over where the conference was being held that was scheming the extermination of your race?
This was certainly where one of the ideas came from. There was something about Berlin. I can't describe the energy. I was happy to be alive. Now, is that in contrast to so much death around me? I don't know. I felt joyous. I can't explain it. I shot up out of sleep at dawn. I walked several blocks to the grave of the poet Heinrich von Kleist. I'm also a translator from the German, and I translated Kleist. And I communed with Kleist and asked if he wouldn't mind if I would borrow a couple of impressions from my stay. And every day I had new vivid impressions that I had to communicate. And the book started in emails to my brother and sister that became fleshed out. And I just couldn't stop. I couldn't stop feeling happy. It's a little bit like that wonderful scene in A Christmas Carol where Alistair Stim starts dancing the day after he wakes up to find that he's still alive. And he says, I don't know if you remember his jig. I don't know anything. I know I don't know any. And there's this joyousness. I felt it every day waking up in the city of Berlin.
Peter Vortzman's our guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves as he explains what it's like to be a Jew who loves the energy of Berlin. You'll find Peter's essays in the Best American Travel Writing series. He's authored Urban Nomad ebooks about Paris and Vienna, plus poetry and short story collections, and he's translated a number of works of classic German literature into English. He's also written a play called Burning Words, and his latest book is called Ghost Dance in Berlin. You're of a Jewish Austrian family.
Both parents, yeah. I grew up speaking German as a first language.
Now, this is the capital of Hitler and Nazism, and your book reads like kind of like a love story of Berlin. How can a Jew love Berlin?
Well, first of all, I've always pursued ambivalence in my life. When I was growing up as a child, my parents were criticized by other family members for keeping the German language alive. And my mother's response was to stop speaking German would be to cut their own tongue out of their mouths. There's been a Jewish presence in German lands along the Rhine ever since the Roman army first got there. It is a part of the history of the country. It is a part, for better and for worse, of the 20th century. And for me, on top of that, Berlin is this immensely creative city. It oozes art. It oozes creativity everywhere, which way you go. Everybody's got a story to tell. There is this anarchic spirit. The city's bankrupt. You never know how it works. The ice is not cleaned in the wintertime, which is a problem because the whole city is like an open skating rink. But somehow you just love it. You love the people that you meet. You love the bratwurst that you eat on Alexanderplatz. You love all the oozing fat of these pork dishes, which for me is the great taboo. And my father, being a very assimilated Jew from Austria, taught me everything that I was not allowed to eat and the pleasure of eating everything that I was not allowed to eat.
What is it about the German fondness of the flesh of the pig and then the Jewish abhorrence of it, and then how people like your Jewish German father having to have that forbidden flesh even if it's not okay?
I think the pig is a totem. It's the image that you see almost everywhere when you walk around Berlin. And it's the image, of course, for me, of the forbidden fruit, forbidden flesh, that my father taught me what you must not eat, and then turned it around and said, the pleasure of learning to eat what you must not eat. He would take us to a deli on a Saturday or a Sunday, Shalon Weber in New York, which was a sort of racy experience, a little bit like taking your sons to the culinary brothel. My mother knew about it, but shut her eyes. There was no pork allowed in the house. But my father lusted after this meat.
Ham hock.
Eisbein. Eisbein is
there. Yeah, you see it on every menu in Berlin. Eisbein.
It's a mythic dish, but nobody dares order it. No Americans dare order it. My father, he's not alive anymore, but I called out to him and asked my late mother's forgiveness, too, for waxing ecstatic and lyrical about this dish on a plate, which is almost Neanderthal dish. You feel like a caveman attacking this piece of flesh, and it's wonderful with a mug of beer.
And Peter, when you write about the bread even, you write, nobody knows how to bake whole grain bread like the Germans. It tastes like it just came out of the oven of Hansel and Gretel. You clearly have an affinity for German culture, even though your family was victimized by the Nazis. Is that not a struggle for you?
Oh, it's a constant struggle. To my mind, it's the basic struggle of my life. Needless to say, the oven in Hansel Gretel is an ambivalent image. That oven was not only used for cooking bread, the witch intended to cook children in it.
And then you talk about present-day Berlin's struggle against neo-Nazis and the graffiti you see in Prince Lauenberg, where it says Berlin against Nazis and so on.
I split my time between a villa on the Wannsee. There were no extra accommodations for my family who came with me to Berlin. So we sublet an apartment in Prenzlauer Berg. And I was deeply moved in Prenzlauer Berg because on May 1st, the traditional workers' holiday, neo-Nazis decided that they were going to march on Prenzlauer Berg. It was going to be a statement. Well, they never got anywhere because I joined the barricades of 2,500 of my neighbors who literally blocked the Nazis from taking steps into our terrain. And I felt deeply moved, and I felt one of them. I mean, the young people on the barricades were moved to see what they called an old-timer. I didn't quite like looking at myself as an old-timer. And then when they found out that I was a foreigner to boot, I mean, they were moved. We hugged each other. I mean, it's a great city. And I am convinced that there was a cultural marriage between two peoples. It was a stormy marriage. It was a rough marriage. It was a dramatic marriage, which gave certainly the 20th century some of the best that it's ever seen and definitely some of the worst. But I firmly believe that Germans, at least of my generation, and I'm 60 now, Germans and Jews, are both children of that cultural marriage that ended in a terrible divorce, and that in fact we have a great deal to say to each other. We have a great deal in common, much more in common than we think.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Peter Wortzmann. Peter writes a book, Ghost Dance in Berlin, A Rhapsody in Gray. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Charles is on the line from Naperville, Illinois. Charles, thanks for your call.
Hey, Rick. Hey, Peter. I wanted to tell you, it's sort of funny, I'm listening to you speak, and I too studied in Freiburg and Breisgau in southern Germany when I was in college in 91, and I was lucky enough, I went on my own, which mostly I went with my friends, but one weekend I went all by myself all the way to Berlin. I took the all-night train and had a wonderful time spending about 48 hours really hardcore hitting Berlin, and I just loved it. I thought it was a great city. And I really exhausted myself, but I had great fun. But one of the coolest things I did, I was a history major and a German double major. Before I went, I Xeroxed all these pictures from books of when the Russians were storming Berlin. And I had these Xeroxes, and when I was in Berlin, I took some time and found where the pictures were actually taken. And it was so chilling to see, like, there were still bullet holes in some of the columns, and to stand where soldiers were standing, where all this history took place. And I was wondering if that's still there, or is that through all the rebirth of Berlin through the 90s, and now has that all been washed away, or is that still there if you go back?
One of my favorite little places in Germany is on top of the Reichstag building, and if you know where to stand and look, you can see bullet holes from there, from the very last days of World War II. If you can imagine a country being invaded from both sides and the defenders finish their fighting on the rooftop, literally, of their parliament building, that's what happened with the Nazis on the last day of the war, as the Americans were pushing in from the west and the Russians came in from the east, and the last stand was literally on top of the Reichstag.
And when you look at it today, that modern architectural type of the Reichstag, it looks a little bit like a prescient eye looking out into the future and onto the past.
Oh, what a stirring building. That's that new glass dome that has been fitted onto the bombed-out hulk of the previous Reichstag that was left as a memorial throughout the Cold War, right on the no man's land of the Berlin Wall.
Now, when I went, they were still building that, but I would love to go back. Is it hard to get a tour of, you know, walk that big circle, cavalcade?
No, it's very easy. You
have to stand on line.
You stand in line, you walk the ramp all the way to the very top and look down over the shoulders of the German legislators from the very top of the dome of their new Capitol building.
It's all about living history, Berlin.
That's for sure. Thanks, Charles.
All right, thank you.
We're talking with Peter Wertzmann. His book is Ghost Dance in Berlin. Peter, you talk about, you know, these ghosts that are jumping back and forth and the frozen Wannsee and everything and the wall dividing the city. And in a way, you also talk about the wall surviving metaphorically today. In fact, you talk about driving around town with a taxi who told you that the wall survives, but in money, not in stone. How does the wall survive today in your mind?
Certainly, if you've been in Berlin long enough and you are of my age, 60, you can quickly pick up who's an Ussi and who's a Wessi, who's an Easterner, who's a Westerner. You just sense it.
Mm-hmm.
That difference has disappeared in subsequent generations. My children were there with me, and they didn't feel it at all.
Okay, but people who spent their youth under communism, you're saying you can tell it today.
Yes, but, you know, there's communism, but I don't want to whitewash it, but there was also a social protective network that certainly the West didn't offer.
Yeah.
There are two sides to it. It's a very complex place full of complete contradictions.
Oh, yeah, and that's the exciting thing, to struggle with it as a tourist and as a writer and a historian like you. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Peter Wertzmann in his book Ghost Dance in Berlin. Peter, are the ghosts still there?
Oh, yes, they're still there. Perhaps most moving to me about the city of Berlin is something called Stolpersteine. Stolpersteine are these brass plaques that you are deliberately meant to stumble on, that is, the pedestrian is. They're polished brass plaques on which there are the names and dates of deportation of individuals who lived in each house. I find myself always perennially moved by this. I have to pause and imagine who was here and whose ghost is still hovering here.
Peter Wertzmann, Ghost Dance in Berlin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Sieben bald nur ich und du, der Herrgott drückt ein Auge zu, denn schenkt uns ja zum Glücklichsein Wochenend und Sonnenschein.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton with Sarah McCormick. Thanks to our friends at the Radio Foundation in New York City for their help today. There's more online at ricksteves.com. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Travel with Rick Steves is made possible in part by the European Union delegation to the USA. Tips about traveling in Europe and information about the EU are available at euintheus.org.